My name is Doug. I'd like to welcome you to the workshop on sanctifying work of silence. And as we move into this time and this material, I'm very aware of the challenge of dealing with silence in a context that requires words. So we are going to talk a little bit about silence, but I think it'd be only appropriate for us to practice it a little bit too, as a way of getting into the territory. So would you be willing to join me in 3 minutes of silence? And here's what I'd like you to do as we enter into this 3 minutes of silence together. I'd like you to just to pay attention to your breathing. Notice your breath. And as you breathe in, would you consider some of the good gifts and graces that God has been giving to you already in this conference? Okay? And with the breathing in, just simply receive and welcome the gifts. And then as you breathe out, would you reflect on and be aware of the ways in which you are here at this conference, not only to receive good things, but that by your very presence, by your life, as well as your words, you are giving out, you are contributing to this world that we live in. And would you let each breath out be a simple offering of yourself in love for the sake of the world? Okay? Breathing in, breathing out during this 3 minutes of silence. Make yourself comfortable. Let's begin. Thank you. for some of you, that 3 minutes might have felt like a long time. For others of you, it might have felt like it was not enough. If you are here today because at some level or in some way you have a love-hate relationship with silence, then you've come to the right workshop. The reason why this is the topic that I'm focusing on today, the reason why I've been lately giving myself to the work of silence and studying silence and reflecting on silence, and is because of, on the one hand, a drawing toward it, which I believe is a drawing of God, recognizing a need for it in my own life and ministry. But also, too, if I'm honest, there are aspects of silence that terrify me, with which I am uncomfortable, and that I find to be very difficult. So, here we are. Some of you are familiar with John Wesley's Covenant Renewal Service, a liturgy that he constructed in the 18th century for his Methodist societies that were really composed of quite an interesting mix and diversity of people, most of whom were Church of England by birth and baptism, but some who were from the various non-conformist churches of the time, Quakers, Moravians, Congregationalists. And in this covenant renewal service, he tried to set forth an opportunity for once a year for the Methodists to reflect on the year that had just passed, to set what had happened in that year in the light of the broader, long narrative of God's covenant relationship with God's people, going back to Israel and extending all the way up through the life of the church. And then affirming both our need of God and God's readiness to offer grace, to invite the people who are at that covenant renewal service to make a renewed commitment for the coming year. Not a bad practice. Some of you have participated in services like that, and if you haven't, I encourage you to do that and to consider how that might be something to integrate into your own ministry context. But there's one little part of that covenant renewal service. It's really the pinnacle. Everything in the service leads to the praying of a prayer. And that prayer includes these words, which some of you, again, may recognize. Why don't we say these words out loud together, just so that we can actually hear them, and then I want us to take a closer look at what this prayer is asking of us. Would you join me? Lord, I am no longer my own, but yours. Put me to what you will. Rank me with whom you will. Put me to doing. Put me to suffering. Let me be employed for you or laid aside for you, exalted for you or brought low for you. Let me be full. Let me be empty. Let me have all things. Let me have nothing. I freely and heartily yield all things to your pleasure and disposal. Wow. All at once, it's a beautiful prayer, but it's also a daunting prayer. It's the kind of prayer that probably each of us would say, this is the kind of prayer I want to be praying day by day. I want to be living this kind of prayer. And yet, maybe also, there are times when we would say, if I'm honest, I'm not sure if I can really say this with all of me. Which leads me to think it's probably the right kind of prayer. Sometimes our praying is too easy. Sometimes praying can seem too hard. The trick, the challenge, is finding those kinds of prayers that are kind of right in the middle, that embody both. An ease that is appealing and that draws us in, but yet which challenges us, which confronts us, which reminds us that this is really about more than what I can muster. I think John Wesley's Covenant Renewal Prayer fits that bill. It's that kind of prayer, which is one of the reasons I think why it's lasted now for a couple of centuries, and I think has a promising future. It's probably not going to go away. I would also like to suggest that for those of us in the Wesleyan holiness tradition, where we place a primacy upon entire sanctification, I think this is one of the best prayers for entire sanctification that I know of. And as I think back over my experience in the Church of the Nazarene, which has been my whole life, we're not usually given prayers to pray for sanctification. We're encouraged to be sanctified. We're called to be sanctified. We're invited to places of prayer for sanctification. But a lot of times, kind of whatever we end up praying, it's up to us. And that's okay. But if you're like me, there are times when I'm struggling to find the words that not only give expression to what God is inviting me to, but also words that keep me on track and call me back. I need that in my own life. So I commend this to you in your work as holiness pastors, in your work of coming alongside others in their journeys towards sanctification, in your, as God provides opportunity, in your moments where a person might be ready and willing and desirous of praying a prayer for entire sanctification, I commend these words, this prayer, as one that can at least serve as a framework for reminding us of what this is about. One of the great features of this prayer, by the way, you may have noticed it, even in your own saying of these words, is that it contains paradox, which is another feature, by the way, of good praying. Prayers that are too easy or too hard often are that way because there's no place for paradox. There's no room for paradox. Everything's been resolved in one direction or the other. And you're left with something that, while at one level it kind of may feel comforting, yet seems to lack something. It's disconnected from what you know life to really be like. Paradox. So there's kind of a both and quality to this prayer. Doing and suffering. Employed and laid aside. Exalted and brought low. Full and empty. All things and nothing. Can you relate to all of that? That's what's so powerful about this prayer. And that's why the praying of a prayer like this is so powerful. Not because there's magic in these words, but because it embodies the kind of full paradox that truly points the way to what sanctification is really all about. A sanctification that in its entireness is not too easy or too hard. Let's take a closer look at the paradox. By first, let's take all the first things in the pairings, and I've highlighted those words in color. It comes through pretty good. I'd like you to look at these words. I'd like you to think about your own experience of the sanctified life. I'd like you to think about that for you personally, but also life in the church and being involved in the church and in ministry in all of its dimensions. And I'd like to hear from you just a little bit about some concrete practical ways that you see these words being expressed in your life, in your ministry, in the context of the church. Where do you see us doing, being employed, exalted, full, and having all things? Where does that show up? What does that look like? Sense of being used by God, and the feel good sense that sometimes comes with that.
I was going to say pastoring, except for the having all things.
Yeah, there you go. Sure.
I wondered that very early. I mean, I experienced that shepherding.
Yeah. So the work of shepherding and pastoring certainly has all of these dimensions to it, doesn't it? Absolutely. Yeah.
Perhaps finding yourself in the center of God's will for you.
Ah, and knowing it, right? Yeah, knowing. Wow, that's powerful.
I'm feeling, it's like I know the other shoe is going to drop, and so all of a sudden, you know,
Yes. Yeah. Which can include even very simple, mundane kinds of things. The kind of routines that you practiced when you get up this morning, the things that are a part of domestic life, wherever you're living. How about Palcon? We're doing a lot of stuff here, are we not? And I mean, quite good stuff, if you ask me. Wonderful stuff. But it's there's certainly the sense of doing, and a fullness to it. Yeah.
It's Matthew 25. So it's all coming. Fullness. No bookends. Just
expansive. Yeah. Which again, we can talk about that metaphorically as kind of an image for various things in our lives, but there's also a very concrete literal dimension to it. Like, what's it like when you have a full church? Yeah, budget's paid in full. When you think about the ministry needs, and you know, think about things like staffing and budget and programming. Isn't it nice if you could have a sense of we have all things? and notice that. There's a place to actually pray for these things, to be able to say to God, let me have all things. let me be full. But you know, there is the other shoe, isn't there? Yeah, there is the other shoe. And this is one of the ways in which Wesley's prayer differs from many of the kinds of prayers that are being prayed in Christian churches around the world. That really zero in on doing, employment, being exalted, being full, and having all things, and make that the gospel. That's the gospel right there. And therefore, just ask God for these things, and they will be yours. That do you recognize that message? And the appeal of it. Because who doesn't want these things? You know, again, growing up in the Church of the Nazarene, one of the things that I picked up on pretty young age was that there was a sense that holiness people sort of had this sense that they're Christians, like other Christians, but there's also some ways in which they really want to distinguish themselves from some other kinds of expressions of Christianity. In a way that sort of said, you know, they don't quite go far enough. I picked that up really. Now that gets translated in all kinds of ways, you know. Sometimes that gets translated into lifestyle requirements, behavioral guidelines, rules and regulations. Sometimes it gets articulated theologically in terms of, you know, well, these other groups, they believe in these doctrines, but we have these doctrines, and right. In spite of the ways that maybe that sensibility has been distorted or misused at times, there's something there. if we are true to our tradition. And I think the something there actually, again, is captured well in John Wesley's prayer. That there is a sanctifying work of God that not all believers are quite ready to enter into. And it's not, it doesn't just ultimately have to do with the denominational labels, right? The gospel of doing, employment, being exalted, full, and having all things. This is the easier front end of Christian faith. This is the piece that has a pretty broad door. And many apparently are walking through it. And sadly, in my view, many Christian ministers of the gospel are making a living off of this. A good living in the terms of the standards of the world. But failing to truly call people into the full sanctifying work of God, which gets to these other words.
On the other one just that you had just up before,
yes.
When you highlight those particular words, one of the things that stands out for me personally is how well am I keeping all those words in balance? Get to doing and get to feeling really employed, then I don't feel very exalted and lifetimes I'm full, I'm empty.
Yeah.
I don't have all things, I have a lot of tiredness.
There you go.
And how that whole balance, I'm wondering.
Good.
That has to say something to us about balance.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. There's quite a few heads nodding.
That's what doing just...
Yeah.
That could be in capital letters.
There you go. Yeah.
You know, Dr. Lee, the idea of... That's really favor. That's the favor of God all over the place. That's... I want his favor. But, you know... Paul in Philippians chapter 3 says, I love that resurrection power, but you got to share in the suffering.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can stop, I've done it. I've stopped at that one verse. And there's resurrection power, but wait a minute. This is the other, and I know you're flipping over it. There's the balance.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the favor of God is in our sufferings.
Yeah.
But we don't want to go there.
Not just that, man. You got me, bro. It's the put me to doing.
Right.
I get to doing because Jesus had not put me there.
Sure. Yeah. Please. Yes.
I think this is a great prayer of consecration. But in this prayer by itself, we do not get to holiness, empowerment, cleansing. All those kinds of things which would empower the positives and make bearable the negatives.
So one of the issues, whenever you're talking about the sanctifying work of God, right, one of the issues is, what's my role and what's God's role? What is being asked of me? And what does God do?
That's why my list is a covenant renewal.
Yeah, yeah. And this, of course, this piece that I've excerpted is set in a broader context. And part of how I think these little pairings that are paradoxical, one of the ways they function, I think, is that they disequilibrate us. They knock us off of our sense of balance. They knock us off of our chair. In whatever level of comfort we may feel we have with how we're doing and how we've set this up, when you go through the whole list, this or this, you know, this or this, it becomes very obvious. This is beyond me. Can you control the balance between doing and suffering in your life? I mean, is this under your control? How about employment or unemployment in all of its dimensions? How about times of exaltation and times of being brought low? Is this your doing? Is this something, you know, you're working? Being full, being empty, having all things happen? No. So as soon as you get, you know, and so let's go to the other side. As soon as you get both of them together, it's like, okay, this is pointing in a very deep way towards a bigger work of God. And then what becomes important is some of the actual phrasing in reference to us. Put me to, let me. Can you already hear the dimensions of surrender sort of in this? The letting go, the becoming open, suffering, being laid aside, being brought low, being empty, having nothing. Saint Ignatius of Loyola, one of the 16th century counter-reformation figures, who, among other things, as a Catholic at a time, so this was when Protestantism had just emerged in Europe. So as a Catholic, was dealing with all of those realities. He was one who really promoted and spoke a lot about the importance of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ as central to the heart of Christian faith. And Ignatius gave a lot of thought and attention to these kinds of sanctifying dynamics. And one of his insights, I think, is very important one, and that relates directly to what Wesley, a few centuries later, was going to be naming in this prayer. And that is this. The balance that is being called for here is not make sure you do everything in your power to have kind of a 50-50 on all these things in your life. That's not the kind of balance that's being talked about. And often when we think about balance, we are thinking in terms of what do we control, right? And you know, you don't want too much of this or too, you know, so let's, if we can get it kind of looking so it's sort of 50-50, that's good, right? The kind of balance that Wesley is talking about here is a placing of oneself before God such that whatever the percentages come out on these things, you're okay with it. You're ready and willing to receive. That's challenging. That's not an easy thing. And yet, it's critical. Is that not getting to the heart of what the sanctifying work of God is really about? Bringing us to a place where we're no longer driven by ego needs. Yes. Not just constructing our lives to match up well with all of our own personal interests and agendas so that we have as good a life as we can, which is one of the main messages that our broader culture gives us all the time. If, in fact, this prayer is truly embodying something important, if it's giving us a nice, a helpful window into what entire sanctification really is about, then I think it's a fair question to ask. Okay, what can help me to daily, in an ongoing way, live in such a way that this kind of prayer is my daily prayer? Not that I have to use these exact words, right? But what can help encourage me to not get so caught up in doing that I'm avoiding suffering? What can help me to not get so caught up in the kinds of ways I am rewarded for being employed that I forget and ignore the ways in which God wants to use me laid aside? What can help me to be more aware of that which exalts me? Even if the exaltation is mainly just at an emotional level, you know what I mean? Kind of where the things that kind of give you emotional highs, I mean, that's a kind of an exaltation. I mean, it's a great thing. A lot of those kind of emotional high points become key things in our lives. But what can help me to be aware of that so that I'm not avoiding the lows? What might help me to not get so content with fullness that I will almost do anything I can to avoid emptiness? What can help me to begin to name those areas in my life where I can, you know, with a fair amount of honesty say, you know, I've got it all. In this area or in this particular, I've got it all. So that I can consider again, well, what if that wasn't there? What if I had nothing in that area? Well, you know, answering that question about what do we need and what can help us, we could spend a whole other workshop just moving into that. But I want to suggest and offer to us today just one thing, one main idea that I've been wrestling with a lot lately, and that is this: that one of the practices we need to recover, and I say recover because it's in our heritage, is the practice of silence. Silence, not a magic bullet. It's not a cure-all for all of our issues and problems. But the witness of people, including many great saints of the church throughout the centuries and across cultures, their witness is pretty consistently this: practicing silence will put you in touch with suffering. Practicing silence will require you to pull aside. Practicing silence will confront you with the ways in which you are avoiding the path of humility, being brought low. Silence confronts you with emptiness. And especially in our culture, which is really quite remarkable in its increasing noisiness, and thereby shortening our already very short attention span for not having anything happening. The practice of silence will reintroduce you to what it's like to have nothing. For all of those reasons, and maybe especially if, as some of our other speakers are suggesting, that exile might be a way of naming the broader context within which we're operating, silence is actually a good exile practice. Yes. Thank you. The silence, the sanctifying silence, really needs to be both personal and corporate. I suspect that maybe one of the reasons why there is so little practice of silence in our corporate gatherings is because it's such a little part of our personal practices. Yeah, we often bring to our corporate life what we are majoring on in our personal lives. And, right? So, in fact, I think especially in the free church tradition, a lot of what corporate worship is personal devotions written large. And so what you get is often a very direct reflection of whatever the personal devotional life of the people who are leading the worship. I mean, that's what you'll get. because that's sort of the mode of within our tradition.
You ever watch when they will do this marvelous song of worship, and instead of letting people God bless worship pastors. They have to riff an extemporaneous prayer. They segue to the next thing that's coming to the pulpit.
Yeah.
And I want to go.
Yeah, like the angel that was up there in the first slide. So if there is very little practicing of silence in our personal devotional lives, in our tradition, chances are it's not going to make it into the public corporate realm very much. So that is a challenge. Now, having said that, it seems to me that to move in a corrective direction of building in a greater practice of silence, I think has to be happening simultaneously in both levels. So we don't have to get it all together in our personal lives before we start making some changes in what we do when we gather together.
Don't you think it's the responsibility of the pastor to try to teach people to understand? Because to them, that's an interruption. I was in a service once, and there was just a small body that the worship had said something about, let's just wait quietly before the Lord. And someone behind me said, what are they doing? I said, so quiet.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. Because we've all been trained to avoid silence. And in fact, one of the reasons why this is getting harder and harder is because now there's actually big money behind it. Now, you're aware of this, I assume, at some level, that the technologies of noise production are big business now. Big, and because of the nature of our economy, right, as a consumer economy, when you get money behind something, it's a tough fight to change and to go against. So, but this is the one of the ways then the people of God are called to be countercultural, right? Again, this is the exile theme. One of the ways that we help sustain our identity and to not lose our identity of who we are in the midst of a very noisy, clamoring culture is through simple practices of silence. But there's all part of the education too, though, is theological. And by that, I simply mean this. We need to know why we're practicing silence. It's got to be more than just, well, you know, you need a little more quiet in your life. Yeah. The psalmist, I think, gives us one of the best, most compelling theological reasons for this. Psalm 46:10, you know this? Be still and know that I am God. That is to say, what's at stake here is not just that a greater percent of the population is losing their hearing at a younger age, although that is happening, by the way. And the trends on that are not looking good, especially because of earbuds. There's all kinds of practical reasons why a little more science could really help our health and all that. But the bottom line for the Christian is this. Without silence, without a practice of silence in our lives and in our communities, there are just ways we will not know God. We're just going to miss it. We won't get it. And so if, as some of the songs we're singing this morning, if going deeper and deeper into the love of God is part of what your heart yearns for, you know, knowing God at ever deeper levels, becoming more and more like God as we mature in our faith, if those are things that you desire, practicing silence is one of those things that actually leads to that. The witness of Scripture would suggest that actually ignoring that leads to problems with idolatry. So we get locked into, for example, thinking that God is basically there to give us all things, to keep us full all the time. I mean, so we get this distorted image of who God is. And we start, and we then gear our, of course, you know, whatever God, how we envision God, that's how we're going to worship. And so our worship actually becomes more and more a praising and a lifting up of this God who is going to give us all things and keep us full all the time. I mean, it's a vicious cycle, right? How do you break out of that? Well, if somebody preaches a blistering sermon against it, maybe a few people will listen. But the deeper, more long-term way to address the problems of idolatry is building into our praying, personally and corporately, times where we shut up, where we stop talking, where we stop claiming to know more than we really know, where we let go, even in our thought lives, start to let go of it all, especially the good things. Let go of the good things. And in that silence, which is not an easy place to stay, but in that silence, God will speak. God will point out and help us to see things that we couldn't see before. God will expose in painful ways the areas of our lives that we thought were sanctified, but are still driven by ego, and graciously invite us again to let go, to be cleansed, to be renewed.
So you're expecting God to talk to you. Is that... this is very important because... I mean, because the world uses silence in the Asian traditions, as I understand them,
sure,
to be, you know, nothing, you know, it's nothingness. We come into the presence of God and say, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth.
Yes.
So, and what you're saying is, and I'm not saying audible, God is ministering to you. He is shaping you. In other words, it's not silence for its own sake.
Right.
It is
silence for the sanctifying work of God. But here's the thing, though. Sometimes, in the silence, there will be a felt sense of God's presence, God speaking, a direction given towards certain thoughts, awarenesses, ideas, whatever. But I got to be honest here. Most of the time, it won't. Which is one of the reasons why it's really hard to stay with it, and I think one of the reasons why we very easily give up on it. But here's the good news in that, see. One of the things that God wants to use silence for in our lives, as part of taking us to higher levels of maturity, sanctifying us ever more thoroughly and deeply, one of the things that God is trying to do is to bring us to a point where we are actually willing to give up our need to feel God's presence. Lord, help us. To give up the need to have an insight. To give up the need to have God speak in a clear voice and thereby know for sure something. And as we stay with God in that kind of a silence, guess what happens? God, not us, God by the Holy Spirit transfigures us and transforms us from within without our even knowing it. In fact, the less we know it, the better. Because one of the great dangers in the spiritual life is becoming preoccupied with how I'm changing. You know, how godlike am I today? And it ironically, it maintains the self-focus that is actually what God is wanting to lead us away from.
Doug, I was born and raised Catholic. There's a big difference between quietness and silence. Huge difference. And
can you quietness? Can you unpack that?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, in my silence, because I practice, I live this, because in our silence, we bring nothing and we expect nothing, but that's our sacrifice. I mean, our nothing is our something. I mean, that's the dynamic
yes.
of the thing. So it's so bizarre because
yes.
I come with nothing.
Yes.
I turn off everything. But that's not just quiet.
No.
The purpose of the quietness is not to do without noise.
Well, in fact, it's impossible. There's been a lot of interesting research done on noise and quiet, just in the research communities. It's impossible to have no noise. In fact, it wouldn't be good for a lot of reasons. So we can't always control all the external noise, although there's a lot we can do that we don't. And more importantly, we can't always control the internal noise. So for the Christian, the practice of silence, again, what you bring to it, what God is looking for you to bring to it, is not another great achievement or mastery. Like, look how good I am practicing silence. What God is looking for you to bring is a simple, humble intention to stay there and to let go and to let go and to let go again and to let go again and to let go again. Even when there's noise around and even when there's noise on the inside, that is not an indication that you're doing something wrong. Actually, that's a good sign you're on the right track. But we need each other to do this, which is why ultimately I think, and I would say this is true in the Church of the Nazarene specifically, because of being in a free church tradition that is heavily influenced by the broader evangelical culture, which tends to be individualistic in many ways, especially around devotional practices. I think what we need maybe most importantly to move forward in this area is to begin to find ways to practice silence together. That will provide a foundation and encouragement that can spin off into individual practice. If all of us just head out from here and try to muster up the willpower and the courage to do this all by ourselves, the prospects are not really good. And I'm not sure that's even what God is wanting as much as the transformed community. Ah, we often think of it that way.
Yeah, so to hear you say
that,
oh, goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
It takes a lot of pressure off.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about personality types and silence.
Sure.
Because I know that pastors, there's a large percentage of pastors that have a certain Myers-Briggs.
Yeah.
And those are not people for whom silence is.
Right. So it is the case, as in every kind of Christian spiritual practice, Bible reading would be listed as another example. Right? In every spiritual practice, one of the factors that's going to affect how one engages the practice is personality. Some things about our personalities might make certain practices a little bit easier, and whereas a different personality will maybe have a harder time with some practices. So I think that's important to recognize. However, having said that, for example, while introverts might be more drawn towards silence than extroverts, the kind of silence that I'm talking about here, which is a lifelong, ever-deepening openness to the sanctifying work of God, doesn't matter what personality type you are, it's not going to be easy. There's no shortcut path if you have the right personality. which is why, again, we need each other, and why I think it's especially important that as congregations, for example, I would love to see more dimensions of practice of silence built into things that we do as a denomination. So even like when we do PALCONs, what would it look like to practice silence together? We need that because it helps remind us it's for everybody. And then we can, as the diverse people that we are, be in conversation with one another about that and helping each other and encouraging one another.
I have ADD and ADHD. I've been doing it.
Yeah.
I've been treated for years. So, to sit like you're good at,
yeah,
isn't good for me.
Yeah.
A low-level repetitive task is like a form of silence.
Sure. Absolutely.
And I got to get earbuds. I mean, trust me, I have no saying on this because, you know, and when the Royals. But I think if there's a freedom to explore,
yeah,
or like walking,
yes,
I it just helps me to be doing a low-level repetitive body motion.
Absolutely.
And having ADD children, that I've learned this too.
I suspect that's what Scott Stearman does a lot in his little studio cabin where he's sculpting. Right? So he's, you know, did you see him this morning? You know, that constant kind of working with his hands. But could you imagine the kind of silence you could enter into while you're doing that? Yeah.
So when you're teaching the students,
yeah,
would you get them to explain what you're explaining?
Yeah.
It's not our tradition.
Yes.
It's not our history.
Right.
You know, and so they come, if they come in with, we're going to be silent.
Yeah.
Cool. Versus putting it in this context.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good. You know, I think that
absolutely
that's so helpful.
And by the way, let me say, with reference to the Church of the Nazarene, this actually is part of our tradition. We've lost it. We've got to get it back. If you read some of the accounts of the early revivals, there were, some of those revivals were really noisy, but then there would be periods of holy hush. Some of you may recall experiences like that, actually. I remember as a young person growing up in my church where that was a regular feature. And it certainly had a significant impact on me, where there'd be just times of extended silence after people had been up at the altar and praying and crying and everything, and then it would just sort of ease into a... And everybody would just sit quiet for a long time. So it's... I was talking with somebody at lunch who had been to one of the Nazarene Youth Congress events. Maybe it was even before... whatever the previous name was, when it had been in Estes Park, Colorado, and how significant it was during that Nazarene Youth Congress to every day have time where they would just go out and walk on the grounds and in that mountain setting, and it'd be unscheduled time, just the sounds, nature, and quiet, and how, in contrast to some of how it's done nowadays, where you're spending a lot of your time in, you know, high light sound filled dark auditoriums with constant, you go to this and then you go to this and then you go to this. So we need to some of this is not, it's not like doing something totally new that we've never done before. It's how can we get back to some of where we've been? Yeah, you know, we've got good friends in other denominations and traditions who have stayed with quiet a lot better than we have, that we can learn from. Absolutely.
Western Holiness of the Clergy, one of our friends, pastors,
yeah,
had us in a time, and it was quite amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know we're at time. Go ahead, you.
Yeah.
Sure.
First of all, my name is Eric, and I am a worship pastor.
Yay!
And I'm using a big part of my music, just to explain to you, we went on vacation, we were first married without music, and after the day I was jittery and my hands were shaking. Oh my God. I'm the guy who hates silence between songs.
Yeah.
But God began working on me a couple of years ago, because you know it takes a while to get through to me. He introduced the idea of silence in corporate worship. And I've been trying to do some of that myself. And yesterday, God started saying, okay, Eric, it's time. This Sunday, I want you to incorporate the time of silence in worship.
Mm.
So I'm trying to think, okay, how do I talk to the worship team? Be ready for that. How do I explain to the congregation that we're doing that? Do I quit, be still, and know that I am God? Or this prayer, or something on the screen? You know, I'm trying to think of the practical ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so let me suggest that you got to take this. If you're a ministry leader, you have to take two tracks. You need to make a personal commitment to this in your own life, which it sounds like you already have, because working with staff, working with volunteers, what they are able to observe and sense from your own life practice carries way more weight than just what you will say to them by way of instruction. So stay faithful to the journey God has invited you on. The other thing I would say is start slow, really slow. And I would say even, you know, if out of your own inspiration you're just kind of feeling anxious, like I got to start something this Sunday. You know, it might actually be best to not start something this Sunday. Part of what silence does as a discipline over time is it encourages us to grow in patience and to take the long view. And I wonder if, for example, just, say, committing a few months to engage in informal conversation with your ministry team people about this might be a more fruitful long-term practice than with good intentions sticking something in a service that nobody's ready for and that could actually backfire, creating animosity that will become more of an obstacle in the long run, you know? Let me just share a couple of resources for you that might be helpful to you. One is Charles Wesley, again speaking of our Wesleyan tradition, wrote this incredible hymn called "Open, Lord, My Inward Ear." It's five verses, and because of time, I'm not going to have us look at all of them, but just notice this first verse and what it embodies about what we've been saying, a prayer. Open, Lord, my inward ear, and bid my heart rejoice. Bid my quiet spirit hear thy comfortable voice. Never in the whirlwind found, or where earthquakes rock the place, still and silent is the sound, the whisper of thy grace. And then he goes on for the next four verses in fairly intricate ways talking about how silence engages the soul in prayer. So you might want to, you can find this online, so you might want to check that out. If some of you are readers, let me suggest a couple of books. Oh, there we go. Oh, one too far. Here it is. A couple of books that I think are really good reads for this. One is by a church historian, and it's called Silence, A Christian History. It's a very accessible but scholarly based overview of the whole of Christian history from the perspective of how silence has been understood and practiced. Great book. And then one that's a little more challenging on the practice level by Maggie Ross called Silence, A User's Guide. So let me commend those to you. If any of you are interested in learning more about or getting connected with Christians, particularly in the Kansas City area, who get together to just engage in silent prayer, there's an organization called Contemplative Outreach. And they have websites. There's a Kansas City chapter. For those of you that come from other parts of the region, there might be expressions of that organization in your area. I encourage you to go to their website. They've got a lot of good resources. And again, you might be able to connect with some people who engage in quiet and silent prayer times together that would, again, give you that corporate connection. So thank you all, and God bless.